Amen. So we began looking at Advent, and we thought we would talk about waiting. Don't you just love to wait for stuff? Don't you love to wait for stuff that takes like a long time? Don't you listen, this time of year, it seems like we're waiting for everything. You get in line at the store, you get in line, going to a restaurant. It seems like everybody had like a second or third car in their garage, and they just brought it out now, right? So that every time you go out there, the roads are all clogged up, we're all waiting for stuff. I don't like waiting. We're Americans, right? We don't have to wait. I got something in the mail from Amazon yesterday that I hadn't even ordered yet. I'm just kidding. But I called them up. They said, we just thought you'd like this, Steve. So we like things quickly. We think of it. We want to be able to get it quickly. We don't like to wait, right? Waiting. But that's what we're going to talk about today. Got a text this morning as I was driving over here from my house from a really good friend. His name is Gary. I haven't seen Gary for quite a while, but I've known Gary for like 36 years. I was 5 when we met. And seeing if you're paying attention. And so Gary is a fantastic guy. He's extremely funny. He's got all this talent. But it seems like Gary has never been able to find that job that just really fits him. It's been agonizing him. And he's worked ministry jobs and secular jobs and all kinds of things. He went to seminary a little bit after me. And it's been like a struggle, a lifelong struggle to find that situation that just fits. And we talk maybe once or twice a year. I called him like last Thursday just for no reason, just to say hi. He said, how are you doing, Gary? He goes, great. I'm going to go for this interview tomorrow at this church in New York. He lives in the Northeast, which is a little tough spiritually anyway. He says, well, I had a great time with this committee, and then I'm going to go talk to their leaders, and it looks good. And I just, so I woke up this morning thinking about Gary, because I knew that it would have happened yesterday, and I got a text from him this morning on the way here, and he said, they said no. And then he said, not sure where to go from here. Can you relate to that? Is there anything you've been waiting for? Feels like your whole life. Well, God loves people who have to wait, and a lot of following Christ has to do with waiting. And so we're going to look at sort of what went up to Christ at Christmas, what all the people in the Old Testament were doing, waiting for him. So we're going to take a look at that and how that applies to us. And as we do this, before we get to Hebrews 11, where I'm going to be, so if you've got a Bible, turn to Hebrews 11. But before I get into that, I wanted to make 4 points about waiting and about faith. And here's number 1. Christmas is the culmination of a long period of anticipation, waiting upon ancient promises. So all these people for 2,000 years before Christ were waiting, and the waiting matters dependent on who you're waiting on and what you're waiting on, and the character of the promiser is what gives encouragement to those who wait upon God, right? God said, I'm going to do this. He's given promises. And it's his character and his trustworthiness that sustains us, and it sustained them through all those years of not really seeing everything come to fruition quite yet. So it's the culmination of a long period of anticipation. Secondly, based on the fact that we're waiting on something that God has said is going to happen, we make choices in life. And when we make risky choices during our waiting, that's called faith. I had an example of that this week. Charlie and I went to go to this training session where we were learning about this curriculum that teaches leaders all over the whole world. And these guys were telling stories about how they've gone to different countries and taught pastors who didn't have any other way of learning and being equipped. And just offhandedly, this one guy said, and we taught these 5 pastors in China over the last couple years. And then we had like a graduation ceremony, even though there was just 5 of them. And he says, and a couple of them tend to go into North Korea to share the gospel. And then they come back out, and then they go back in. And that really caught my attention because I went, wait a minute, what? They're doing what? I mean, ministry in China might be difficult enough, and they're going to go to North Korea on purpose and go in there somehow, share the gospel, talk to believers. I was stunned. I was like, that's risky. That's about the riskiest thing I can think of doing in our world today. So sometimes when we make choices based on what we believe is going to happen because someone promised it that we trust, we make risky choices. Thirdly, sometimes these choices look foolish to the world around us. You know, we make a choice, or and maybe some of your friends or maybe your relatives go, you believe in Jesus, really? Really? It seems dumb. Or they might say, well, it's okay to maybe intellectually believe in it, but not to base your life on Jesus Christ. I mean, he's invisible, right? It's interesting, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, it says, the message of the cross is foolishness. It seems, and the word there means silly or absurd. The message of Jesus Christ seems silly or absurd or foolish to a lot of people. And yet, we make decisions based on following Christ, and to some people, it's just like, that's really dumb. So I have a friend named Ron Ritchie, and he's 20, I was going to say he used to be 20 years older than me. He's still 20 years, it just stays the same, right? He's still alive, and he's 20 years older, and he's a mentor. And we got to work together for years, and Ron is just, he just loves God, and he loves people. And he's got this way of meeting new people all the time, and he actually says this. When people say, Ron, what do you do for a living? He says, I tell people about Jesus Christ when they're interested. Are you interested? I mean, he actually does that. And he's always got some story about somebody. And one way he does it is he gets to know them. And one way he found out, I don't know if you remember, wallets? Remember those things? People used to have wallets. You put money in them. And now I just have my phone. And but back then, you would have like pictures. Well, now we got pictures. I'm sure he could put pictures on his phone, but Ron would get confused. So he always loves to show pictures of his family to people, because that breaks the ice, right? And then you get to know this person, and he does it. So I was with him once at an airport, and we were going up to get our ticket or whatever, and there's a long line of people, and I got my ticket, and I walked away, and I look back, and Ron is up at the thing, and what's he doing? He's got his wallet out, and he's talking to this lady on the counter, and he's going, well, here's my wife, and here's our kids, and here's our grandkids, and he was just doing his thing about getting to know her, but there's this long line of people, and I can see her eyes are like glazed over, and she's like, you know, sir, we've got, and I look back, and you know what I thought? I thought, Ron, that's silly. What are you doing? It just seemed foolish at the time. It just seemed dumb, right? And I caught myself thinking, Ron looks foolish. But I realized, why is he doing this? He doesn't care, because he thinks everybody needs to hear about Jesus. And this is just how he does it. And if it looks dumb from time to time, he just doesn't care. He just doesn't care. So we're waiting on these things that God has said is going to happen, and we make choices that are risky, and they sometimes look dumb. And number four, often these choices require leaving the comfortable for the uncertain. Leaving the comfortable for the uncertain. And so we're, at Christmas time, we're engaging in these practices that bring us in touch with the tradition of people who anticipate something coming, and they're waiting, and they're making choices, and they're leaving comfortable situations. Let's just look at a few of them in Hebrews 11. If you have been in church for like several years and you hear Hebrews 11, you probably think, oh, that's that list of people. That's the Hall of Fame, right? All these Old Testament believers. And the point of Hebrews 11 is he's illustrating the idea of faith. And he's using examples from all these people's lives about how they live their life based on what God said was going to happen. So, verse 1, Hebrews 11, 1 and 2 say, now faith is confidence in what we hope for. And again, biblical hope is not just, oh, I really wish this would happen, or I want to, here's my Christmas list, right? Biblical hope is that God has said something's going to happen, and so our hope is grounded in something he says is for sure. Faith is confidence in what we hope for and assurance about what we do not see yet. This is what the ancients were commended for. When he says ancients, he's talking about people in the past. So this writer to the Hebrews, it's a New Testament book. We don't know who the writer was, but he's writing to a bunch of Jewish people who have heard about Jesus and embraced Jesus. And he's writing to them to bolster their faith and to tell them what you've done is a good thing, because some of them were frankly feeling the cost. And some of them were like, I kind of like was comfortable just being a Jew in Jerusalem with my community. And now that I've believed in Jesus, I'm kind of getting pushed out and that's kind of hurting. And I just don't know, should I hang in there? And he's saying, yes, this is what the ancients, this is what the people in the Old Testament, this is how they lived. C.S. Lewis said something I always have loved. He said, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. So all these people we're going to look at, really made for another world. And so are you and I. Verse 3 says this, by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command, so that what is seen was not made out of what was visible. So this is kind of looking backwards. The rest of it's going to be looking forwards. But looking back, God says, here's how the world came to be. It just didn't show up. It just didn't start at the Big Bang. Even if there was a Big Bang, I was behind the Big Bang, and I caused the Big Bang to happen. All this is just not impersonal plus time plus chance. God was there. He said, I did it. I own the universe. I'm in charge of the whole thing. I created it. And we trust that he's true because we weren't there, right? And now he's going to look forward. In verse 6, it says, without faith, it's impossible to please God. Because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists. Number one, can't have a relationship with God if you don't believe he's there. And it's okay to say, God, I've got some questions and I've got some struggles and sometimes I've got doubts, but I believe you exist and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. That simply means I believe that God is there, he's not silent, and he's going to respond to me as I seek him. That's how you start out in a relationship with God. I'm going to seek him. I believe he's going to respond. I believe he's there, and he will. And so let me tell you five people's stories. They start off right after this. So that's kind of his thesis. And then he's going to go through all these different people, and I don't have time to go through all of them, and aren't you glad? Verse 8 starts with Abraham, father of the faith. You've heard of Abraham. It says, Abraham, when called to go to a place he would later receive as his inheritance, obeyed and went, even though he did not know where he was going. I love that fact. God says, Abraham, he talks to him when he's in Ur of the Chaldees. He's in this pretty big city for that time, Mesopotamia. He says, this is kind of a comfortable life you're living. I want you to leave it. I want you to go live an uncertain life. I want you to just start walking. And Abraham's probably like, well, where exactly are we going? Just trust me. Just start walking. Your whole life is going to be a journey from now on. And so it says, by faith, he made his home in the promised land like a stranger in a foreign country. He lived in tents. And that's a big deal, as did his son and grandson, Isaac, Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he was looking forward to the city with foundations whose architect and builder is God. And so God says, I want you to just start walking. Trust me, you're going to go to this place. I know you don't know where it is. And I want you to live the rest of your life as a nomad. You got a nice house here. I want you to just give that up and just trust me. And so he lived in a tent. And the deal with a tent is that it's kind of vulnerable and you can move it around easy, right? And so when Jesus showed up, there's an interesting word used about Jesus in John chapter 1, where it says the word became flesh and what? Dwelt among us. And the word dwelt means tent. And so Jesus lived his life kind of like Abraham. He did, Jesus had a home till he was about 30. He lived there with his mom and his family. And at some point, his dad probably passed away, Joseph. But then when he starts his ministry, he's living like in a tent. He doesn't have a home base. He's staying at other people's houses. He's wandering around. And so Abraham is doing the same thing. And when God initially calls Abraham, he says, Abraham, let me show you something. He goes outside. Here's all the, you could actually see the stars back then. And he says, look at all these stars. You know, your offspring is going to be like this. He goes, I'm 75. Really? I don't have any kids. And God says, no, trust me. You're going to have offspring as many as the stars in the sky or the sand on the seashore. Just trust me. And Abraham's like, I'm having trouble with this because I don't have any kids. And his wife, Sarah, she couldn't have children. And so after a while, even though they tried, she's like, you know, I don't think this is working out so well. Why don't you have a kid with Hagar, my maidservant? And so they tried that. And God says, no, that wasn't my idea. Abraham, you and Sarah are going to have a kid on your own. And by then he's going, I'm almost 100 now. You know, how is this going to happen? In fact, God visited Abraham and Sarah in the form of these three guys. Look this up in Genesis 18. He shows up and says to Abraham, and then Abraham's scurrying around trying to have a meal, you know, a feast, because that's what you do back in the Middle East. You have a feast for visitors. And one of the guys says, hey, by the way, Abraham, next time, about a year from now, we're going to come and visit you and Sarah, and she's going to have a little boy, you know, a new baby. And so Sarah's in the tent, and she's overhearing this, you know, she's eavesdropping, and she just starts laughing her head off. She's laughing, like, right, this is going to happen. And you got to be careful when you do this with God, because God overheard her. And the Lord says, hey, and Sarah, you laughed. Why are you laughing? And she goes, no, I didn't laugh. And I love, he says, yeah, you did. So God always knows what's going on inside your heart. And so they're struggling. And that's the point, is that these people that are used in Hebrews 11, if you read their stories, you go, well, they weren't perfect. And that's the whole point. If you think about Abraham, I mean, it's not like he was great at everything. I mean, he was cowardly at one point. He's, you know, somebody liked his wife. So he said, well, she's not really my wife. She's my sister. Like, really stood up for her. And he did that like twice. And then Sarah, you know, she's laughing. So it's not that these people were absolutely perfect in their faith, but they still went on their journey. They still followed God. And that's like us. I think it makes us able to identify with them, right? Because you go, well, I can take like 3 steps forward, 2 steps back. If you look at my journey, you know, it's like I go off on these tangents, and there's days that I'm just like right on target, and other days I'm just like out there. And that's what these people were like, but they still walked by faith. And so then he goes to Moses. Moses in verse 23, by faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child and they weren't afraid of the king's edict. The king wanted to kill all the baby Hebrew boys because this is in Egypt and there's too many of them, right? The king says, we got to get rid of these kids. And they didn't. And so miraculously, this little Hebrew boy ends up being saved in a basket. He's a baby. And he gets into the Pharaoh's court, you know, and he lives there and grows up there. And he's doing this for 40 years. So he's got all the education, all the resources, all the stuff. I mean, every time an iPhone comes out, he gets one like the first day and have to wait for anything. He's smart, he's intelligent, he's trained, he's educated, he's handsome. He's got everything going for him. And right at age 40, he goes, you know, I think I'm going to identify with my people. So he ends up kind of making a mistake there. He kills this guy and he ends up going out to the desert. But what it says here is, by faith, Moses, verse 24, when he had grown up, refused to be known as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. So again, here's somebody, and what happens is he's, you know, 40 years he's growing up, then 40 years he's out in the desert. He's just with the sheep and the goats and his father-in-law, and he's not really doing anything. And he's just thinking, this is the rest of my life, I guess. I'll just be out in the desert. At age 80, God says, hey, Moses, just decided now to make you the deliverer. I'm going to send you back to Egypt, and you're going to bring all these people out. It's going to be great. And Moses is like, no, I'm too old. You should have called me 40 years ago, and I can't talk anyway, very well, so why don't you use somebody else? God says, no, you're going to do it. So he goes back to the most powerful nation on earth and says, let my people go, right? So this is Moses. And then he goes through this whole process for the next 40 years of shepherding these people through the desert, and they're not happy most of the time. If you want to read what it was like, read Psalm 90. Pretty sure it's 90. Moses wrote it. He goes, here's what it's been like living in the desert for 40 years with this group of people. And he finally gets to the top of the Dead Sea where he can see the land, the promised land. If you ever get to go over there, it's right there. It's like the border's like right there. And he gets to see it, but he doesn't get to go in. He dies. So he doesn't get to go into the land he's been waiting for his whole life. Who does take over? Joshua takes over, right? And so Joshua takes over, crosses the Jordan River, goes into the land, and he's like the new quarterback, right? So it's like you hear about this new quarterback. He's been great in college, set all kinds of records. And I just imagine, they're getting ready to do their first battle, right? So they've a new leader, Joshua. He's younger, he's great. He's got all this experience. He's got to be this great general with lots of strategies. And so I just imagine them in the huddle, right? Because they're going to fight Jericho. That's the first city, big walls. It's really fortified and everything. So I imagine everybody's in a huddle, right? And the quarterback kneels down and says, here's the play. And they're all just excited because this is going to be so great. And then they say, what are we going to do? How are we going to conquer Jericho? And he goes, well, first day, we're going to march around the city. They're like, man, build a siege ramp, right? Nah, just going to march around the city. And then like shoot flaming arrows, right? No. And like, it's like catapults. How about that? No, I'm not going to do this. Just march around the city. All right. Second day, what are we going to do? March around the city again. And they're like, all right. Then like the third day, march around the city. Fourth day, we're going to march around the city again. Fifth day, we're gonna march around the city. Sixth day, we're gonna march around the city of Jericho. And they're just like, really? This is our best guy? Moses is dead. Is there anybody? And then he goes, seventh day though, things are changing. On the seventh day, we're marching around the city seven times. And then we're gonna just start screaming and yelling and blowing trumpets. And just trust me, it's all gonna work out. And I'm just sort of there thinking, this is the best we got, right? And they do it, and what happens? It all works out. They go around seven times, they blow the trumpets, they start screaming, and the walls fall down. It says it right here, right? In verse 30, by faith the walls of Jericho fell after the people had marched around them for 7 days. Amazing. Everybody gets defeated. Except one person and her family, and that's the person in the next verse. I love Rahab's story. This woman named Rahab, it always calls her the prostitute Rahab. I'm sure she appreciated that. Didn't stay a prostitute after she met the Israelites, but she was one up until that time. So by faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. Why choose her for an example of faith? Because she was just in Jericho. She's just this prostitute living there, carrying on her business, and these Israeli spies come in, and she knows she ought to tell everybody about them and get rid of them, but she has been thinking about this for a while. She's been hearing about this nation that is coming up the east side of the Dead Sea, and she's been hearing about them, and everybody in town is afraid of them, but she's latched on to this idea that they have a God who's the God of heaven and earth. And somewhere in her heart, this woman Rahab has come to believe in him. And so lo and behold, she's got these two representatives of this new Israelite nation. They come to her door and she goes, this is my chance. So she protects them. And even when people are looking for them, she says, oh, they left a long time ago. And she protects them and she says, okay, guys, here's the deal. And I'm going to let you out the window. You're going to climb down this red cord that everybody can see, I guess, at night. And I want you to protect me when you come back and destroy the city. And they're going, fine, just make sure that cord is out your window so we'll know which one not to blow up, right? And so so she does. And so they come in and they conquer the whole city of Jericho, except for her house. And Joshua says, make sure you protect Rahab and her whole family. I just love that story. There's this woman, Rahab. She believes in this God she's never seen. She's just heard about him. And the risk, if they had found out what she had done, she'd be dead, right? And probably her whole family. But she you know, lays all her cards out. She trusts. It's very risky. And then, after the whole thing, Joshua says, well, you can kind of live with the nation of Israel, kind of on the outskirts. You know, we're going to have this camp, and you can be part of us. And then guess what happens? That's at the end of the story? No, here's what else I love about Rahab. Very first page in the New Testament says what? A record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, son of Abraham. And then it goes through all this is where it gets lost in the New Testament, right? Abraham's the father of Isaac. Isaac's the father of Jacob. Jacob's the father of Judah. Judah the father of Perez. Perez the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. Ram the father of Amminadab. Amminadab the father of Nahshon. Nahshon the father of Salmon. Salmon the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. So she not only gets to live, she not only gets to be part of Israel, she ends up marrying this prince named Salmon, and she ends up in the genealogy of Jesus Christ, whom she had been waiting on her whole life. Is that amazing or what? And so the point of all this is that we come from a tradition of people that have waited for stuff and made risky and foolish-looking decisions to just leave what's comfortable and go to what's uncertain. And so even down to Jesus' day, and we'll cover this in the next couple weeks, you know, you remember in Luke chapter 2, there's this old man, an old woman, and the old guy, his name is Simeon, and God had promised him, you're not going to die till you see the Messiah. And lo and behold, here comes Mary and Joseph with the baby Jesus. And then there's this woman, Anna. And they're just like Old Testament saints. They're just living up until Jesus' day, right? So when I thought of a modern-day person that exemplifies this, I thought of a lot of different people, but specifically I thought of Johnny Erickson. And you may or may not know about Johnny. She's a woman. Her name sounds like Johnny, but it's J-O-N-I. We would think Joni. Johnny was a real athlete back in her high school days. She was always riding horses or swimming or playing tennis or doing something, you know, extroverted and out there. And one day, 1967, she's 17 years old, she is going to play tennis with a friend of hers, and the friend calls and says, I can't do it. Can't do it. So she goes, well, I'm going to do something else active. I think I'll just go swimming. So she goes to the Chesapeake Bay, and she dives in. She didn't jump in. She dives in. Wherever she was, that particular spot was too shallow. There was rocks there. She immediately breaks her back, and she's just floating there until her sister finds her. And of course, she goes through all these surgeries, and she's placed in this metal contraption that flips her over, and she's praying for healing, and it just doesn't happen. And she's got a relationship with Jesus Christ, and she goes, why would you let this happen to me? Maybe it'll be over real quickly. Maybe I'll get healed. And it just doesn't happen that she gets healed. And so she wanted to kill herself to put herself out of this situation, but she can't. She's quadriplegic. She can't move her arms or her legs. The only thing she can do is from her head up. And she struggles, man. She goes through depression. She goes through all this. And at some point, for some reason, somebody says, well, maybe you could draw by putting a pencil in your teeth. I mean, what does that sound like? But she tried. And guess what? She was really good at it. She says, I'm left-mouthed, not right-mouthed. I can only, you know, put the pencil in the left side of my mouth. And then she started drawing stuff. And she kind of got famous, and then she wrote a book about her life. It was called Johnny, and then people made a movie about it, and she started this whole ministry thing. But she always was hoping that she would get healed, and she had this dream that she would go to the Pool of Bethesda in Israel. If you've ever heard that, and remember in Jesus' day there was a pool, and you can still go there today, and there was a legend that every once in a while an angel would come and stir up the waters, and like the first person that got in would be totally healed. Well, it's just a legend. But Jesus did heal somebody there. And she thought, man, if I could just get there. And people would have a little saying or a little song they would sing about that, saying, Lord, please don't pass me by. And she was thinking, you know, if I ever could get there, Lord, just don't pass me by. I want to be healed. I want this to be over with. Well, that was 50 years ago. 50 years ago. Johnny's still around. She has this tremendous ministry, but she's the first to say, this is really painful. She says, I get up every morning and I say the same thing. I can't do quadriplegia today. I just can't do it. I'm weak, I'm tired, I'm frustrated, but God, if you give me the strength, I can do it today with some help. She got married to a guy named Ken Tata many years ago. And what she says now, it's interesting. She says, I really, really look forward to getting a new body and walking. I really, really want to walk. But you know what else I want to do? She said, I want to kneel. Because if you think about it, she can't kneel. She says, people always ask me, how do I hang in there? And she said, I'd rather be in this wheelchair knowing Jesus than walking around without him. And she says, someday, he'll be back. It'll all work out. But she did get to go to the pool of Bethesda a few years ago, and she was there, and she started to weep, and she said, you know, people think that maybe God passed me by, but I want to say God did not pass me by. He's been with me the whole time. And I wouldn't trade anything for this. It's difficult. It's hard to wait. And so what we're going to do in just a minute, we're going to get up and have communion. And we're going to do this by intinction. And if you haven't been here before, we go to one of these four tables, and all of the bread is gluten-free for those of you who have trouble with that. And we're going to take the bread and take the cup. You dip the bread in the cup, or if you want to take one of the cups, you can do that. And we were remembering that Christ came. And I think the surprising thing is you look at all these Old Testament characters and you go, they were probably waiting for an event or a situation, but as things became more clear, they began to realize this is a person we're waiting for. This is a person. And now we look back and go, well, God showed up in person in the person of his son, and he gave himself for us. And so when we take this bread, we remember that he was given a body and he allowed that to be broken for us. And he shed his blood for a new covenant, a new arrangement where we're in this relationship with God for absolutely free. And we proclaim that truth until he returns. So we're anticipating his return. So let's look at the last part of this passage. I love the way it ends. 13, 14, 15, it says in Hebrews 11, all these people, Abraham, Sarah, Moses, Joshua, Rahab, all these people died still believing what God had promised them. They didn't receive what was promised, but they saw it all from a distance and welcomed it. They agreed that they were foreigners and nomads here on earth. Obviously, people who say such things are looking forward to a country they can call their own. If they had longed for the country they came from, they could have gone back. But they were looking for a better place, a heavenly homeland. That is why God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he's prepared a city for them. He wanted them to wait so that they and us together could be in the kingdom. But isn't that line fantastic where God says, he's not ashamed? You know, it's like he looks at us and we're these stumbling people and we make all these mistakes and we have our good days and we have our bad days. And on our worst day, he looks at you and he says, you're my kid. I love you. I'm not ashamed to be your dad. I'm not ashamed to be your God. Those who are following me, as frail as we are, and as many times as we fail, he doesn't seem to care. He just is not ashamed. In the same way that it says Jesus was not ashamed to call us brothers and sisters. So let's remember him as we wait for him. Let's pray together. Jesus, we are so thankful that we know your name, that we've heard of you, that we've read about you, that we've come into a relationship with you. We're all waiting for something, and for some of us, it's hard, it's frustrating, it's disappointing, it's discouraging. Strengthen us through your Spirit while we wait, and encourage us through the community of our brothers and sisters. But as we take this bread and this cup, we remember what you did as you came to rescue us, and your death on our behalf has given us life. And we cling to you, and we know that you will one day return for us. Amen.